Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Year in Review. As today we talk about key papers and presentations from the past year in prostate cancer. We have a great faculty today, Dr. Andy Armstrong from the Duke Cancer Institute for Prostate and Urologic Cancers in Durham, North Carolina, and Dr. Maha Hussain from the Robert H. Lurie Comprehensive Cancer Center, Northwestern University Pineberg School of Medicine in Chicago. As always, if you have any questions or cases you'd like to run by us, just type them into the chat room and we'll talk about as many of these as we have time. There's a one-minute pre-meeting survey in the chat room for you to take, and we repeat it again at the end of the meeting. If you do this, you'll get a lot more out of this experience. We know a lot of people end up listening to our webinars and other programs. If you're into podcasts, check out the Oncology Today podcast series, including a recent program with Dr. Shore and Taplin. We are heading out to the Society of Gynecologic Oncology meetings in San Diego. So if you're going to be out there, check out our two programs next Monday. First on cancer of the ovary. We have a great program headed up by Katie Moore. And then at noon that day next week, also a program on endometrial cancer. So much controversy going on there on the use of IOs and the management of this disease. We'll be working with a Florida cancer specialist again in March. We're in March, I guess, actually, in a couple of weeks. We've got almost 400 docs heading over to join us here in Miami. We'll be spending the weekend with 35 investigators talking about all corners of oncology. And actually, we have a program there with Drs. Antonakis and McKay on prostate cancer. And you do pretty well if you're a urologic oncology fellow to check out our 12:30 to 3 p.m. with bladder cancer, renal cell. We've got some great speakers there as well. We'll be bringing back our Meet the Professor series with the program of myelofibrosis in April the 3rd. But we're here to talk about prostate cancer. Nowadays, it's tough to get through even the basics of this disease in an hour, but we're going to give it a shot. As we do in all of our year in review programs, I met with each of the faculty separately in the last couple of weeks to record in-depth presentations reviewing some of the key papers from the past year. And really, the ideal way to use this content is to use both of these presentations as well as what we're about to do here in the next hour. Here are the papers that are covered in these presentations. We're not going to go through this in detail. We also discuss these papers as well as have them presented. What we're going to do tonight is sort of take things to the next level and ask a key question, which is, how are you managing prostate cancer today compared to 1 year ago? And what data sets influenced any changes you might have made this year? And you can be sure a lot of things happened in the past year in prostate cancer, to me, particularly in the M0 space. But I just want to start out with a little bit of a sort of a side thought. You know, we originally were going to do this program last week. We had to reschedule it for today. But the day before we were going to do this program, we did a program on bladder cancer. It was actually, part of this year in review series with Dr. Gupta and Dr. Tom Powles from the UK. And I just wanted to relate this as kind of a humorous anecdote, but also there's, I think, a message behind it that I'm just kind of curious what our faculty thinks about and what you think about. I'm going to ask you to think back 4 years. Not a long time, 4 years ago today, March the 6th, 2020. And of course, in my mind, March the 13th was the day everything changed when ASCO got canceled. And that was the last day we were actually even in our offices. We never even went back there. And it was interesting to reflect back on how things are today and how things were then. And one thing I'll say about today is we could never put on a program like we're doing right now 4 years ago. We couldn't do 90% of what we're doing right now 4 years ago. We have jumped into, as an education group, we have jumped into this technology, and what we are doing is very, very different and very exciting. And what I want to ask the faculty is how, you know, their day-to-day life's been affected by technology. But here's my anecdote. So it's always exciting. I meet with the faculty for about a half an hour before we start a webinar. We talk about what's new. They update me on things that maybe I don't know. So when I started to do this, I was expecting to see Tom in his living room. I've done a ton of Zoom. I even know the paintings in his living room by now. And it didn't look like he was there. And I was like, Tom, where are you? And he goes, well, I'm in Tokyo getting ready to go into a convention and do a presentation. And I'm like, oh, okay, well, you know, when are you going to get there? Well, anyhow, here's what happened that weren't updated this year that are included in, you know, sort of the clinical management, you know, platform. Are you still driving, Tom, or did you, I guess it looks like you are, right?
I'm not driving. Someone's driving me, but I'm basically there, Neil. It'll be okay.
Okay. Yeah, that's great. We could do it. We've never done one with anybody in the car, but who knows? Anything is possible.
It's like carpool. It's like carpool karaoke, Neil.
That's right.
And we hear him. I think that the surroundings.
So, and with about 30 seconds to go, he walked into the convention center. I said, do you have your computer? He said, yeah, I have it, but it's kind of old. I said, is there a room you could, like, go into? And he's looked around now, and I said, can you just sit down and, like, put that phone in front of you? Let's see if it'll work. And if you watch that program, perfect video, perfect audio for an hour. I don't think anybody had any idea that he was sitting in the corridor of this, you know, convention center. So, you know, for us, you know, you have no idea what it's like to try to do a webinar before 2020. And we drive out to these places with these huge, you know, satellite things and all. And also the cultural acceptance that has allowed us to do this is just amazing. I'm just curious. I'll start with you, Andy. Any thoughts about how, you know, the pandemic and the acceptance of communication technology affected the way you do things, research, education, patient care?
Sure. Neil, thanks for the question. And certainly the pandemic has affected patient care. For a while, we learned all about telemedicine through Zoom and how to care for our patients and make things easier for them. I'm down to maybe only about 10% virtual meetings now. We really prefer that interpersonal interactions and the face-to-face time. And that's true of research, lab meetings, you know, and conferences. I really, you know, taught me to really appreciate that interpersonal interactions. But it also flattened the world where I can give a talk in a remote part of the world or even from a remote part of the world like Tom Powell's there and without having to travel and burn a lot of gas.
Incidentally, for those of you who were on our program last night in year in review, Dr. Andre also had no internet. He was home. It was midnight in Paris. He was home. His Wi-Fi wasn't working. We said, like, again, 1 minute before he started, turn on your phone. No problem. No. Any thoughts, Maha? Do you find, you know, now we can go to conferences so much more effectively, get data? You know, ASH didn't even have a virtual meeting before the pandemic. Do you find people more informed, more up to date as you deal with them, Maha?
Well, I think, you know, maybe I can make a comment first. Remember, humans survived millions of years despite challenges and no cell phones and no computers, because we know how to adapt. And I do think what COVID did, it opened up a door of adaptation to try to ensure that we can do what we're supposed to do and what we need to do and what we want to do and not have to do it necessarily in person. I think that in general, I think what made it easier for patients in the business we're in is that they never had to drive, and that made it easier. Significant others could join, and that made it much easier for them. But as I was mentioning earlier, the reality of it is this, is the person-to-person interaction is very critical at all levels, whether it's patient care, colleagues, trainees, mentees, so on, but definitely with the patients, because not seeing a person, not examining them can potentially impact the quality of care.
All right, well, let's get into the main issue here, which is new data in this exciting field. And we're going to start out reviewing some of the things that Maha got into in her talk about hormonal therapy. And Andy, of course, one of the themes there is intensification. We started to see that with hormone-sensitive metastatic disease several years ago, and now we're moving down the spectrum, as we're going to see. Also talk about the issue of hormone-sensitive metastatic disease. I want to really focus on what you all are doing in your own practice. the issue of the role of docetaxel, the Arasens regimen, and then new approaches to hormonal therapy. Andy, just looking back, though, this sort of general global issue of hormonal therapy over the past year, from your point of view, what were some of the key highlights from you, at least in terms of, you know, potentially having practice implications?
Yeah, Neil, that's a great question. I would say in the past 2 weeks, I've talked about the EMBARK data several times, and so that's an immediate impact. We have a recent drug approval of enzalutamide with or without ADT, honestly, in men with non-metastatic hormone-sensitive prostate cancer, and that's a study of great interest to patients, not just because they might be able to delay metastasis, but also to be able to stop therapy. And now we're talking about intermittent intensive therapy. So that's something that's pretty unique just to the past year. I think the ARSIs, whether it's darolutamide, APA, ENZA, or ABI, have all kind of carpet-bombed prostate cancer now and starting to move from CRPC to MHSPC to now maybe even more impactfully trying to cure more advanced localized disease, you know, where you can target a therapy for a definite period of time, 6 to 24 months perhaps, and then stop therapy and see if you got it all, you know, and maybe incorporating metastasis-directed therapy, radiation to the primary, really seeing better outcomes for our patients is really meaningful.
We're about to sort of go through some of those pieces. Maha, same question to you about the content that Andy covered in terms of other treatment approaches beyond hormonal therapy over this past year. Cus lutetium over the last few years has such a profound impact. Also, PARP inhibitors are rapidly moving forward. Any thoughts, again, on where you are today, Maha, on some of these strategies compared to about a year ago?
Well, obviously, we have significantly more options compared to even 5 years ago for patients at this point. And certainly, this is great news. And I do think that as we move to effective treatments into earlier stages of the disease, the return on investment in terms of clinical benefit is clearly much better than sort of waiting until late stage disease to administer it. But one of the issues that I think we are lagging behind is as the field is evolving so rapidly, what used to apply to patients a year ago may not apply to them now. And the issue comes up is mechanisms of resistance, how does the disease progress on a triplet therapy? And then how do you manage them, you know, in terms of like different AR targeted agent, does cabazitaxel going to work in someone who's had triplet and now, you know, are progressing. So there are several things that I think are going on. So there is the blessings of having multiple different options for patients, but the reality, we have not cured the cancer yet. And clearly, I think moving the field forward is going to be moving things into earlier stage disease where potentially the impact on the disease may be much bigger, such that we might be able to even potentially cure the disease or significantly prolong survival.
And, you know, I'll just add in from the perspective of, you know, general medical oncology, the entire field, including hematologic oncology. Certainly what's happening on prostate cancer kind of reminds me a lot of what's going on in breast cancer, particularly in terms of hormonal therapy. So many new interesting mechanisms that are being looked at, a lot of advances in biology in both of those fields that I think are going to have big payoffs for patients. All right, well, let's sort of get into sort of more the nitty gritty of what actually happened and where we are today. And I love this graphic that Maha has in her talk looking. And of course, you see different kinds of, you know, graphics trying to depict the stages of disease and some of the things that happened over the past year, the key trials. But we're really looking at it from the perspective of community docs and practice and what they need to know in order to deliver excellent care. And I just want to start out actually with a topic that Maha didn't really cover because there wasn't a lot this year, but there was a lot the year before and before that, Andy, which is high-risk localized disease, locally advanced prostate cancer, where and there are a lot of people who fit into that category. In the past, ADT has been used along with radiation therapy. But now we're seeing intensification coming in with abiraterone and maybe more. Can you kind of talk a little bit right now, Andy, about sort of how you think? I don't know if you see these patients at Duke or urologists. Probably you talk about them in conferences. but how you think through these patients and in what situations you intensify therapy and how you do it.
Yeah, thanks for that. Yeah, we have a multidisciplinary clinic, Neil, where patients who are newly diagnosed can come in and see urologic, radiation, and medical oncology and get that, you know, transdisciplinary opinion. And certainly some men prefer surgery, and we counsel them on the high risk of needing radiation with or without hormones post-op for those high-risk features. And many patients are now coming to our center with a PSMA PET scan already in hand, and so that's a new change where just 2 years ago we didn't even have that approved. We are also now incorporating a number of biomarkers, whether that's a genomic score like a Decipher score or an artificial intelligence digital pathology biomarker. You know, I presented at ASCO last year on a long-term ADT predictive biomarker, where basically you can lump high-risk patients into kind of two groups, a group that may be able to get away with just the same outcomes without long-term ADT, and a group that probably does need treatment intensification, maybe not just long-term ADT, but drugs like Abi or Enza, darolutamide, which is now being tested prospectively. And so moving into that more personalized or precision approach where, you know, not all patients are treated in the same way, but stratified based on their risk using biomarkers, their comorbidities, their preferences, I think that's a much more personalized way of approaching this.
What, Andy, what about the second issue mentioned here on this slide, PSA relapse after radical prostatectomy? Any situations where you use endocrine therapy or intensified endocrine therapy there?
Yeah, I think we've learned from a number of RTOG trials that early salvage radiation can improve survival, that some of these men can go on to live normal lives and not die of their prostate cancer with just salvage radiation. We need to not forget to refer patients early and not late, that there are some patients where ADT can synergize as a radiosensitizer in that setting, 6 to 24 months, particularly for those who need late salvage or those with a high genomic or Gleason score that have a higher risk of distant metastases.
So, Maha, let me introduce the one topic that always gets a lot of attention in general. I'm not sure where to talk, whether to talk about it here or in 5 minutes, but it's just so relevant, which is what Andy alluded to, the PSMA scan, and how you deal with people whose conventional scanning is negative, whether it's in a localized M0 setting, and also whether or not, you know, I hear stories about using, you know, identifying oligometastatic disease and using local therapy. So can you just talk a little bit, as we talk about how the research, as it's moving into us, how it's being affected by the availability of PSMA scanning, Maha?
So the PSMA scanning, I think imaging in general is something that we have to be mindful of, that it's actually a tool to help us make a decision. It should not be the only thing that you would use to actually make the decision. Clearly, it will help for sure. PSMA imaging, I think, is a very important technology, but I would like to highlight the fact that just about every level one evidence we have in the context of prostate cancer management at this point is based on conventional imaging. Clearly, the trials are needed to see how the PSMA can be integrated in terms of the early stage of the disease, in terms of guiding therapy as such. What I do actually in my clinic there is this, depending on the circumstances, a patient who has a PSMA PET imaging positivity, I would actually also do conventional imaging just to see if there's, you know, just to contrast and match. The other thing, again, we tend to be biased by our experiences. Certainly, I am, you know, to disclose that. I've had situations where you do a PSMA PET and then you wait 6 weeks and repeat it again, and some things that were lighting up, I call it, you know, they're PET avid, but not necessarily enlarged lymph nodes or something like that, actually fade away. So there is multiple things that you know, you need, one needs to look at, and generally we really interact quite nicely with our nuclear medicine colleagues who are very helpful in terms of guiding things. And ultimately, I think it's the totality of the picture. It's the seriousness of what you're seeing on the scan, and then, of course, a shared decision in terms of your recommendation to the patient and a shared decision. Now, clearly, if you see a nodule in the lung, that's a separate story. You see enlarged lymph nodes, a separate story. But I would caution that sometimes just because there is radioavid lesions, it doesn't always mean there is necessarily definitely 100% metastatic disease.
So chat room starting to warm up a little bit. Andy here, Nicholas, who always comes up with interesting questions, wants to know which patients should get ADT alone. And Charles wants to know, has a patient at first follow-up after prostatectomy has a PSA of 2.2 PET pending.
So Nicholas is probably talking about the metastatic hormone-sensitive setting, I assume, and in our practice, about 90% of such men will receive treatment intensification. In the community, the latest data is somewhere around 50 to 60%, and those numbers keep improving year by year. It's never going to reach 100%, and that's because some of our patients have comorbidities. They have extremes of age. They have preferences. They may also prefer an intermittent approach, where MAHA has pioneered that in metastatic disease, where some men actually can have treatment of their oligometastatic disease and enjoy a break, you know, particularly if they've achieved a complete remission. And so, you know, ARSIs are not for everybody, but I think the vast majority of patients should be offered them, that should go through counseling about the level one evidence around improving survival, and they should be considered the standard of care for the vast majority of men with conventional imaging metastatic disease.
How about this case with PSA 2.2?
Yeah, so are you talking about a relapsed patient? Is that what the question was?
Yeah, well, it's a patient had a prostatectomy, first follow-up, PSA is 2.2. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so this would be considered late salvage. This would be a case where I might consider a PSMA PET scan. That patient would have a higher probability than an early salvage patient of having detectable pelvic adenopathy. And I think what we're seeing now is that we're sculpting the beam, the radiotherapy, to encompass the PSMA avid areas. This patient would probably be counseled on pelvic radiotherapy with prostate bed radiotherapy in conjunction with ADT. We don't have data for this patient yet, depending on the imaging on an ARSI, but I would be okay with using it if they had N1 disease. How about you, Maha? Would you use ARSIs?
Well, absolutely. I think so. It's again driven by the risk. Somebody based on the pathology. And the fact that if this patient developed a relapse very shortly after surgery or never achieved a nadir that's undetectable, clearly this is a high-risk disease. The one thing I would say, definitely repeating the PSA to confirm there's not a lab issue, that this is actually rising PSA or at least detectable PSA. The second part I would say, in the patients who have very higher-risk disease, so to speak, definitely the intent would be to, from my practice, I usually counsel the patient on more of an intensified salvage treatment with the hope of cure as opposed to not. And so generally we would favor the combination of radiation. And by the way, the standard of care should be pelvis and prostate bed, not just the prostate bed, because certainly there could be lymph node microscopic disease in there. And definitely androgen deprivation and therapy intensification and duration is going to be driven by like how bad of a risk features. I do see some patients, for example, who have had surgery and they were pelvic node positive and never got any adjuvant treatment and now they relapsed. And these kinds of patients, I would err on the side of a minimum, maybe 2 years of systemic therapy.
Let's move on now. And, you know, Andy was saying, he was talking about hormone-sensitive metastatic. I want to know when you use LHRH without intensification in M0 disease in high-risk situation, Andy. But let's talk about these two trials, particularly the EMBARK study, but there was looking at enzalutamide combined with ADT and alone as monotherapy intermittently, as we were alluding to. And we're still in the process of, you know, sort of bringing this into practice and sorting out how it's going to be brought into practice. Andy, can you talk a little bit from your point of view, first of all, globally, when you look at PRESTO, which, of course, looked at apalutamide and also EMBARK, you know, kind of how would you compare them? It seems like PRESTO maybe is a little bit earlier and maybe compatible with what was seen in EMBARK, but maybe a little earlier. What were your thoughts about this, and how did it affect your practice, Andy?
Yeah, I mean, EMBARK is really considered a phase 3 study, sufficiently powered with a robust endpoint that is a surrogate of, you know, overall survival, and also showed a very strong trend to survival. PRESTO, I consider more of a phase 2 study, signal-finding study, with a PSA endpoint. And both showed benefits, but I think only the EMBARK study had sufficient power to show a metastasis-free survival with about 9 months of this treatment intensification over ADT alone in these biochemical high-risk patients. So they had to have doubling times less than 9 months. The EMBARK is not for patients with slow PSA kinetics, where we often observe these patients very safely for sometimes 5 or 10 years without anything bad happening to the patient. But for these high-risk patients with rapid kinetics, these patients have a higher mortality rate. They have a higher risk of metastasis, as you can see in this curve here, that by about, you know, 7-8 years, that half the patients have developed metastases with ADT alone. But ENZA plus ADT, you know, can really delay or prevent metastasis for this very long-term follow-up of this study. So this is a positive study. And the great thing is that the treatment's only 9 months. And the average intermittent period was about 21 months. So you're spending more time off therapy than on therapy, which gets at the favorable quality of life and economics of this, which would be much better than treating patients continuously.
And Maha, we were reflecting back last night, actually, because we were looking at a trial of ipi/nivo in MSI high that had a hazard rate of 0.21, which we never saw in colon. And we were reflecting back last year, last November or October, when we were with the Florida cancer specialist, Matt Smith from MGH, showed a slide from the EMBARK study. He called it a pelican graph, you know, for obvious reasons. And so colon cancer got their first pelican graph, but you guys have had some for quite a while. Maha, of course, one of the most interesting things about this study was the intermittent enzalutamide monotherapy. Again, they got treated initially, and once their PSA went away, they were, you know, brought off therapy. Once it came back, they stayed on. But the monotherapy arm beat, although I guess it wasn't technically statistically designed this way, looks better than what we've been doing the last 20 years in these high-risk patients. A lot of controversy. I'm really curious about quality of life and what we've learned in terms of ENZA alone versus ENZA plus ADT. Any thoughts, Maha? Do you offer this as an option to your patients?
So I do discuss it with them, because to be fair to them, clearly there was a positivity even with the single agent, with the enzalutamide. Obviously, there is other side effect issues, gynecomastia, things of that sort that could be a downside. But generally, when I counsel my patient, I really counsel them on what I think is, based on the data, what is their best chance of getting cancer control. And I will say, when I discuss with them, because as you know, was it last summer that the FDA approved the data from this trial, and now you can prescribe enzalutamide. I would say so far my patients have opted for the more intensified approach.
Neil, my biggest concern about ENZA monotherapy is that when you stop it, you progress more quickly.
Yeah.
And so that's a big downside to it. Yeah. Not only the breast growth and painful gynecomastia, but the short break off it when you stop it, because you've got very high testosterone.
Testosterone, correct. Absolutely.
It kind of reminds me of tamoxifen, an increase of estrogen level here, increase of testosterone. There was actually a 9,000 patient adjuvant study done like in 2000 on bicalutamide. They saw this gynecomastia, but it seemed like they could prevent it with a dose of radiation. Well, anyhow, to be continued, we're going to be talking about EMBARK for a long, long. To me, that was the paper of the year in oncology, not just in GU oncology. All right, some other issues related to hormone-sensitive metastatic disease. We've talked a lot about these issues over the last a couple years, as we've seen data, particularly coming through the ARISEN study, looking at darolutamide. One of the things that we've seen, and actually I see we were talking about the same thing, in a, believe it or not, in ovarian cancer, in terms of the rapidity of decline that you see. This is the TITAN study with apalutamide, where we see people who had PSA declines in ovary, they have the Kellum score, how quickly the CA125 drops. Any thoughts in general, Andy, about this clinical variable and applying it in your practice?
Sure. So Maha pioneered this variable as a nadir with ADT alone, and we learned that you can separate patients using that nadir based on that post-treatment PSA, usually by about 6 to 9 months, between 4.2 to 4 and less than 0.2. That also now applies to these treatment intensification programs, whether it's docetaxel or an ARSI, and you can see that you can really separate patients widely in their survival. And so that's very simple readout. You can update a patient's prognosis from maybe a poor risk to a favorable risk, simply as a readout of the tumor's biology and the sensitivity to ADT and AR inhibition.
So Maha does a great job in her talk going through the Arison studies and all the follow-up data we've been looking at in the past couple years. But I just want to focus down, again, in practical clinical decision-making. You can comment in terms of whether it changed in the last year. But two key clinical questions I want to kind of run by you. Whether or not to use docetaxel added into ADT plus some type of intensification. And also, what type of intensification? Abiraterone, one of the androgen receptor blockers. So let's start out with the question of whether or not to use docetaxel. Maha, can you kind of summarize? We don't have a trial comparing ADT plus hormone intensification plus or minus docetaxel. For practical purposes, Maha, how do you decide whether to add it in?
So I think, generally speaking, it's all going to be driven by multiple factors. The volume of the disease at diagnosis, was it de novo, as in synchronous metastatic disease at diagnosis versus not? The issue of comorbidities and other factors, obviously safety, and then, of course, patient preference. Having said that, I would say right now I am applying the triplet therapy in the vast majority of my patients. Now, again, my practices generally tend to be patients who really, for whatever reason, have very high risk disease or they're younger. So even somebody who has, let's say, low volume disease, but let's say de novo lymphadenopathy when the patient is 48 years old, to me, this is the kind of situation where I would err on the side of going with the triplet treatment. There are times where definitely doublet, and I can bring an example because, you know, we have another meeting coming up tomorrow, and I've used that example in there where a patient who might have had, say, isolated lesion that got resected and turned out to be metastatic disease in the lung, and there's no other disease whatsoever, and it's a synchronous, not metachronous type metastatic disease, and then not much measurable disease otherwise, aside from some lymph nodes. These are the situations that I would err on the side of the doublet treatment. When it doublet, as in with AR inhibitor, and Andy is absolutely correct. None of the clinical trials had a control arm, and in fact, I should say, Neil, you are absolutely correct. Then none of the trials had a doublet arm of an AR inhibitor plus ADT. Clearly, that is a challenge, but. One of the issues I think is this is the data that we have today are in terms of like best outcomes seems to be mostly with the triplet treatment. Certainly the data with doublet is very strong also. So, but they were not compared. And so that's the hard part. And this is where really the clinical judgment has to come into play.
So we often face in oncology situations where we don't have the data we'd like to have. Yeah. Andy, I'm curious about your approach to the use of docetaxel. But Andy, another question I have is choice of AR inhibitor, because, you know, we have heard from a number of people. I can't remember exactly what your thoughts are. I have to refresh my memory about relative toxicity of the available agents. Darolutamide is favored by a lot of people. We know investigators will go across, we'll use it even without chemotherapy, which I think is not impossible to do. I'm curious from your perspective, anything you want to add to Maha's description of whether she uses docetaxel and how you choose a partner, including abiraterone as a possibility for your partner to the ADT?
Yeah, my default, Neil, is triplet therapy for the high volume patients, whether it's synchronous or metachronous, although high volume synchronous mm-hmm. is much more common. I will counsel patients, just like Maha said, where it's a very personalized, informed decision making. The choice of the AR inhibitor, you know, is really going to be ABI or darolutamide with concurrent therapy. We lack the data with concurrent therapy with APA and ENZA. If you've already given ADT docetaxel and then you're going to give maintenance therapy afterwards, like we did in ARCHES or TITAN, then you could use a sequential therapy. But I really try to avoid ENZA, you know, concurrently with docetaxel. There was increased toxicity in Chris Sweeney's charted trial, for example, ENZA-MET, for example.
Just putting aside whether or not, you know, the docetaxel issue, let's say they're not getting docetaxel. From your point of view, and particularly your clinical experience, how do you compare the tolerability of the available agents, and what's your preference?
Yeah, I think a lot of it comes down to cost, honestly, because these are all very well-tolerated agents with very striking efficacy, very similar efficacy. I don't think there's an efficacy difference between them. I do think there's differences in drug interaction. Mm-hmm. Darolutamide probably has the fewest adverse events on the heart, on the bones, on the muscles, on fall risk, on fractures. So that is a great agent for older patients. For younger patients, I think they're all very similar in terms of quality of life and toxicities. They do, you know, some of these other agents that are not darolutamide, because they have effects on bone, you really need more intensive bone density monitoring, encouragement of exercise, blood pressure monitoring. But most patients do very well with any of these choices. They're all winners.
Maybe I can chime in one thing, though.
We're going to run out of time if we don't move on here. I'm sorry. We're actually going to skip the next section. I refer you to Ma's discussion of the use of potential use of CDK inhibitors, the cyclone studies looking at abemaciclib, but then as often occurs in oncology, we just see a press release suggesting this or saying that the cyclin 2 results adding abema to abiraterone did not meet the primary endpoint. So we'll see how that develops, whether or not you'll follow in the path of breast cancer, getting into AKT blockers, et cetera. But how about if I just run a quick case by you, 30-second case? Okay?
Okay.
So, Maha, tell me what your thoughts are. This is Dr. Atif Hussain here in Broward County and near us in Miami. Atif was at Duke, Andy, and came down here, runs the Hollywood Memorial Hospital Cancer Program. He's been reviewing our programs for like 20 years. He said, present this case to them. 76-year-old man presents metastatic hormone-sensitive prostate disease, metastatic disease, gets started on leuprolide. This is 2018. Did really well, did not want to be intensified, had only lung mets, no bone mets, refused any therapy in addition to leuprolide, and did great for 5 years. And then he shows up with progression, and I'll just save that. He has germline testings negative, NGS is cooking. So, Andy, any thoughts about this case? It's interesting. There are at this point, no bone mets. We'll show you the images in a second. He clearly had new lung mets. Any thoughts about the case?
Yeah, I actually have one or two patients similar to this. And lung-only metastases have a more favorable prognosis, mm-hmm. Neil. We've published that with Susan Hallaby, for example, and others have looked at this group. They tend to be enriched in DNA repair alterations for some reason. I'm not sure why. This patient's never had an ARSI. He certainly would deserve it now that he has mCRPC. Probably could have been offered it early, but he obviously did well for 6 years without it. And so, maybe he had an SPOP mutation, which is ADT sensitizing mutation. I'm just kind of guessing at what you're about to show me, but
I guess you didn't see this slide. So anyhow, his NGS is cooking, but here's his Guardant 360. He's got an AR mutation that connotes resistance to hormonal therapy. He's got a BRCA2 somatic mutation, allele percent DNA 0.2%, and MSI high. Here it is, MSI high. He's getting another biopsy, but Dr. Hussain is thinking of TMB 42. Again, this is off the garden. And you can see where he started out, had a great response, now progressing. We'll see what happens.
Neil, this is, case. Oh, yeah.
Go ahead.
This is a case where the MSI high is actually driving the BRCA mutation. So here, most likely, the BRCA2 is a passenger rather than the driver, and this high TMB is a result of a mismatch repair. And so I would probably offer him pembrolizumab, honestly.
That's exactly what – I know it's hard to believe you get pembrolizumab before an AR blocker, but that's exactly what he's going to do, and we'll see what happens. We'll follow
up. I would disagree. I would go with a combination PARP and AR inhibitor.
Oh, PARP and AR, yeah, sure.
Yeah, this is exactly where the frontline patients would have fit.
Incidentally, does it bother you that the AR mutation that supposedly is related to resistance, Andy, does that bother you?
No. No, I mostly ignore those parts of the report because that's not really true anyway. I would have great confidence that he would respond to an AR inhibitor, but I would have a low confidence in the PARP responsiveness because it's more of a passenger alteration. These MSI high related BRCAs are often monoallelic, for example.
Yeah, but even when you look, Andy, just so it's we can agree to disagree, but when you look at the data with the MSI high and you give them IO, the rate of response is not exactly amazing.
It's about 50%.
Well, so try it. And there's the reality of it is this, where there is much more powerful data, more durable responses, I would say, with the combo. So if I were advising him, that's what I would, offer him. Now, clearly, if he's asymptomatic and there's not like humongous lesions in the lungs, definitely you can try the IO and see how things go and then, there. But I don't think he should drag things out.
I don't think he is. So anyhow, we'll see what happens with this. And let's move over and start talking about radioligand therapy. And, of course, Andy goes through this in great detail in his talk. Here are some of the issues that we talk about and from a practical point of view that I wanted to query the two of you about. But first, from a global point of view, Andy, as you look back over the year, and again, your talk, you go through a lot of these data, but I just want you to maybe give us a macro view. From your point of view, what were some of the key things that came out over this past year, key developments in the use of this strategy?
Yeah, nothing's changed my practice more as a medical oncologist than PSMA lutetium. I feel like we've become almost like a service center for PSMA lutetium in the Southeast because there's not that many sites who are giving it, and we've treated almost 300 patients now in the past 2 years. And, seeing the VISION study, the PSMA-4 data, the potential movement into the chemo-naive space, I think, it's really just gratifying to see alternative mechanisms of action be successful here, and patients are lining up for those discussions. Certainly, we counsel patients about docetaxel, cabazitaxel, radium, and alternatives, and we know that PSMA lutetium is not a curative therapy, but it can prolong life. It's a very important part of our armamentarium for our patients. We counsel patients on the radio, protection and the radioactivity precautions for their loved ones as well. But it's a pretty well-tolerated therapy. It's rare to see a drug improve quality of life while improving quantity of life. And that's what we've seen with this agent. We look forward to, newer developments of new radioligands, that builds on this, attacking non-PSMA targets, using alpha particles, moving this into earlier settings, maybe using it in a risk-adapted way where you don't have to give all six doses, but a shorter course to really cytoreduce. So we've learned a lot from this experience.
Any comments, Andy, on what we learned, particularly about prediction of benefit, any correlation between PSMA findings and benefit? And also, I was asking you during your talk, it kind of occurred to me, I don't remember hearing about ADCs in prostate to PSMA. I mean, you ADC in everything in oncology. Why isn't there an ADC to PSMA? But any thoughts about predicting benefit and ADCs?
Yeah. Well, first for the PSMA radioligands, we have two papers that are submitted right now. One is looking at the PSMA PET characteristics predicting the benefit of PSMA-targeted therapies. And the brighter the tumor, the greater the benefit, which makes sense. There's more target antigen, more radiation delivered to that tumor. And so we presented that data at ASCO. And, you know, it suggests that more bright patients may benefit greater if you're on the fence between, for example, cabazitaxel and PSMA lutetium. And then a very simple test to really reassure your patients who are responding is the PSA. So the deeper the PSA decline, just like you saw with apalutamide or enzalutamide or docetaxel, the better patients tend to do. And although there are discordant cases, you know, and among my first 10 patients, I saw one patient with a PSA decline who developed liver metastases. So we have to be aware of neuroendocrine transition. Transformation can occur where tumors can shift away from AR and PSMA dependent. That's why we need ADCs. You know, ADCs against other targets, not just PSMA, but neuroendocrine targets. We need radioligands against neuroendocrine targets. We have to be prepared for that, what we call lineage plasticity, to emerge over time.
Yeah, some of the most interesting things I thought in your presentation, I don't know if we're going to get to it, is some of the things that are being looked at in terms of neuroendocrine strategies, yes. Like it's being done in small, all of a sudden, small cells all. Yeah, interesting. So just kind of curious, Maha, again, from your perspective, particularly clinically and what you see patients and families go through, also interested in what you've seen in terms of xerostomia. What do you do to either prevent it or manage it? How do you see families and social situations complicating this in terms of radiation precautions? Any thoughts?
There has not been, again, once we counsel our patients and their families, that we have not really had any challenges in that regard. Some of the challenges that we've seen actually has nothing to do with the sort of the xerostomia, but more the bone marrow suppression, which has been very problematic. Now, mm-hmm. In all fairness, this is, you know, again, these patients have been through multiple lines of treatment, but definitely I think one of the concerns I have, and because I did have a couple of patients like this where we actually did a bone marrow biopsy and there was no tumor, but there were no cells. And so this is something we have to be mindful of. The alpha particle, I think is very interesting, and hopefully there will be, you know, again, trials are going to hopefully get started, and potentially may have the better effect in terms of stronger anti-cancer effect and hopefully short-lived radiation effect on the tumor. But from a everyday practice thing, family stuff like that, we have not really had any issues.
So, Andy, any comments on these other agents? I know we got it here in the slide deck. There was another, but I thought it wasn't as effective. But you tell me, what do we know about other radioligands targeting PSMA?
Well, as you've seen from press releases, they have not made as much of a splash.
So, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so we've seen
the paper.
Exactly, the splash trial only improved progression-free survival by 3 months over a pretty inferior control group of a second AR switch, versus the PSMA-4 study, which used, you know, the standard Q 6 week times six dosing, maybe a higher radiation delivery, really doubled PFS, you know, from 6 to 12 months. So the splash may have been more vulnerable to just not enough dose, mm-hmm. you know, not enough. May have been a great drug, just not enough was given.
Mm-hmm. What about the idea of combinations? You showed this combining it with olaparib. What's the sort of biology? What do you think happens mm-hmm. when you add a PARP inhibitor to lutetium? And what do we know about this clinically?
Yeah, PARP inhibitors are really exquisite radiosensitizers. You know, they actually block DNA repair. And so think of lutetium as inducing single and double-stranded mm-hmm. DNA breaks. And so the idea behind using olaparib is to prevent that repair. And, you know, this is a great study, phase one by Dr. Sandhu in Australia, showing an objective response rate of nearly 80%, a PSA 50 of 66%, very highly selected mm-hmm. patients, but really identified a recommended phase two dose where you couldn't give olaparib continuously. You had to give it kind of in a burst of -4 to +18 days for each 6 weekly cycle. Did show some preliminary data around efficacy and was safe to give. And they have some nice biomarkers showing that the PSMA CTCs go away.
So we'll see where that heads. You also went through some data combining it, for example, here with enzalutamide. Interesting. But also a question we get in patients who have bone-only mets or PSMA positive, what comes first, lutetium or radium, and what do you see? Of course, I think most people think about lutetium because you see responses actually there. But can you? What happens if you give radium first? Andy, what was seen here, or was it? What happened if you use radium first?
I think the key data here is that there is efficacy and there is safety, but like Maha said, there's increased bone marrow toxicity, particularly thrombocytopenia, anemia. You have to be prepared to transfuse your patients, that there's a cumulative effect on the bone marrow with both of these combinations.
So, yeah, let's move on and talk about PARP inhibitors, although I have to say that thought about bone marrow toxicity is not something I've heard a lot about myself personally, so I wonder if it's really getting out to the community, because initially I didn't hear too much about that, so I'm going to sort of file that one away and make sure to start asking other people about it. All right, let's talk about PARP inhibitors. We mentioned that we're just getting ready to head out to SGO. You can imagine we've been talking about PARP inhibitors with a gynecologist for a long time. It's so interesting to see as it comes into breast, prostate, and pancreatic cancer. And again, I guess here are some of the general questions we've had over the last couple of years. We can talk about what we learned this year that tied into that. But I guess the first question is what type of workup to do in a patient with prostate cancer, at what point they should get a germline testing, what type somatic, should they get them both? Maha, for a patient presenting who has metastatic disease, in general, when are you thinking about doing the testing? What type of testing you do, and exactly what sequence?
Sure. So I think the critical part is going to be depending on when you're seeing the patient, what you need to do for them. But anytime, actually, my patients, especially if they have de novo metastatic disease or very rapidly progressing disease after local treatment, these are the kind of patients that I would absolutely opt to check for NGS. If the patient has a, you know, by general criteria of whatever the national guidelines are in terms of germline testing. Having said that, I would say, again, for patients with de novo metastatic disease, family history, things of that sort, definitely I would opt to, and the family history of other cancers, obviously, opt to do the germline testing. I do the somatic also, and generally we try to do it, request the test at the same time just to speed up the process. If the patient, and now that we have the ctDNA, that would be like the simplest things to do. The one thing that I advise colleagues and my patients, if the ctDNA comes back negative and the patient has tissue available, and or if they don't have tissue available but they potentially have disease that can be biopsied, I would then opt for looking at the tissue in that regard to see what's there. And, you know, we've had really quite a bit of successes right now in terms of the whole strategy of combining PARP inhibitors with AR inhibitors.
So we're still getting comments about that MSI-H case, but I'm just going to leave that for the time being. So I think I'm going to get a bell, and I'm going to ring it. This is going to be called the Neil Bell. Every time I hear something that I figure I should have heard a long time ago, but I'm hearing for the first time, and I would have rung that bell during Andy's presentation. So here we go, Andy. I want you to explain it to people, which is the difference between BRCA2 and BRCA1 in prostate cancer is much greater than I thought. You know, I was thinking about, you know, breast. We had gotten the message there's a lot more BRCA2, but I got a very different feel from you, Andy, about BRCA1. Like, you almost never see it as opposed to it's less common. And you're like, even when you see it, you're not sure it's there. You want to make sure it's biallelic and that BRCA1 is really not a player in prostate cancer. Is that right?
It is an interesting puzzle why BRCA2 in prostate and why BRCA1 in breast and BRCA2 in breast. So in prostate cancer, most of the drivers
and ovary.
And ovary, of course. And, you know, the germline syndrome, BRCA2 is got prostate cancer in that syndrome, but the BRCA1 patients really, that's prostate cancer is not really a major player in that familial syndrome. So there is some biology there. It may have to do with the luminal and AR differentiation and the regulation of these genes, but in the end, we mostly are seeing BRCA2 as the main driver of PARP sensitivity in CRPC. And we very seldom see BRCA1 in the PROPEL, PROFOUND, TALAPRO. BRCA1 is maybe only 5% of all the BRCA, you know, alterations that occur. And most BRCA2 alterations are biallelic. They do create that synthetic lethal, you know, relationship with the PARP inhibitors. BRCA1, I'm not saying it can't, you know, and in fact, like I have a patient this week just with that scenario, but it's much less common.
So Priya in the chat room says I should play the dolphin song every time I learn something I didn't know. I like that idea too. So Andy, again, updating. Of course, the big story over the last couple of years in terms of PARP inhibitors has been earlier use combined with AR pathway inhibitors. There are three data sets that you talked about in your talk. I recommend people to go through and through the talk, and it really goes through very carefully and contrasts the different studies. But how about putting it together into about 35 seconds, Andy, in terms of comparing the three trials?
Well, so olaparib and abi and talazoparib and enza are really the major practice-changing trials. They clearly show that the greatest benefits are in the BRCA patients, but there can be some patients who benefit who have non-BRCA HR mutations. The olaparib PROPEL study did show a survival benefit in those BRCA patients. The TALAPRO2 study is still maturing for survival, but both trials very consistently show a substantial delay in progression-free survival, both in all comers, but mostly driven by the BRCA carriers, secondarily by the non-BRCA HR alterations. I think the main question that I have is going to be moving these into the hormone-sensitive setting where the phase three studies are happening now and where we actually are using these AR inhibitors now, where I seldom see a patient come to me who is truly a first-line mCRPC, PROPEL, or TALAPRO type patient anymore. So I'm looking forward to those results of what we call TALAPRO3, the AMPLITUDE study, and the EVAPAR study, which is a PARP1 selective phase three trial. So that's where I think the PARP inhibitors are moving towards.
It seems like maybe endocrine-sensitive metastatic disease might be, quote, the sweet spot, or maybe it could be earlier. I don't, you know, we'll see, I guess, Maha. But right now, I can imagine if you have a patient with a BRCA mutation, BRCA2 mutation in front of you, and you can't, they can't get on a trial, would you ever consider using it outside a trial in that setting, or you need to wait?
No, I generally go with what has shown evidence of benefit. And I think theoretically, if you think about it, and again, this is more theoretical, those who have the BRCA2, if anything, may respond better to the chemotherapy. Who knows? But the reality of it is this. At this point where we have the level one evidence is really with the ADT and the chemotherapy at this point with the taxane. Trials are going to be needed. And the issue, one thing to remember, just because things work in the castration-resistant space isn't necessarily going to be that the deliverable is going to happen in the hormone-sensitive space. This is where AR seems to be much more dominant in the hormone-sensitive space in terms of its sort of effect. And so with that, I would say I wouldn't randomly use it.
Yeah, and also these men live for a long time. You maybe AML and MDS is going to be a consideration. And
I do worry about that.
Five or more years of, you know, we presented this case. This man went 5 years just on ADT. Okay, right. Andy, here's the case that I actually put in the pretest. This is for you, okay?
Okay.
55-year-old, I'm going to see if you change their answers, okay? A 55-year-old man has been on ADT for M0 recurrent prostate cancer and now develops metastatic disease, including visceral mets. Germline and somatic mutation test results are negative. LOH, negative. Regulatory and reimbursement issues aside, would you offer a PARP inhibitor to this man?
So the first point I'd make is not all visceral disease is created equally. Liver metastases are what I think Maha and I worry about the most, with lung metastases having actually a favorable prognosis. Mm-hmm. So I would first ask you to clarify that. So if it's liver metastases, I'm very worried about that patient because actually none of our therapies do very well in the presence of liver metastases, unfortunately. Although we still use them, the prognosis of these patients is more limited. The progression, the resistance happens more quickly. And that's true with an ARSI, docetaxel, cabazitaxel, and PSMA lutetium. that doesn't stop me from using them and offering them. And I've had some patients with liver metastases still do very well for many years. But this is an area of unmet need where some of the drug development is occurring. You know, we just published in Cancer Discovery AMG 509 or xaluritamig, and that was very active in liver metastases. That's a bispecific T-cell engager.
Okay, let me just pin you down a little bit more. Okay, are there any situations where you would give a PARP inhibitor to somebody who doesn't have BRCA, doesn't have LOH? Can you describe a situation where you would do that?
Yeah, so this would be an example if the patient is fit and healthy and after informed decision making, we're going to do an AR inhibitor, and I would talk to them about a PARP inhibitor. And in that visceral subset, there was a progression-free survival advantage, so that would be part of the discussion. You know, if he's willing to accept a little more toxicity for potentially a longer progression-free survival. Absolutely.
And incidentally, I'm just going to finish with Maha's thought on this, but while you listen to Maha, take a look at this. Here's another, I'd say, pretty close to a pelican graph, right?
That's a These are beautiful the BRCA, pelican.
This is a pelican getting ready to open his mouth. So, again, Maha, any situations outside of trial you can access a drug, would you do it?
Well, I think one thing that I would stress, and that is do your homework first and make sure that the liver is biopsied to make sure that this is actually not a small cell, switch. Mm-hmm. And that happens, by the way. And so that's going to be very critical. The second part would be definitely do the genomics on the liver in the context of basically no HRR mutation, no BRCA2 kind of thing. In those kinds of patients, I would probably err on the side of going with chemotherapy and potentially platinum added to taxane.
One thing to add, it reminds me of a case, Neil, is that I had a patient with liver-only metastases that I biopsied and found that it was cholangiocarcinoma. So the biopsy is really important. Yeah. And some patients can be cured of localized liver primaries or bile duct primaries. So, you know, a biopsy is really important.
Yeah.
Good point.
I've had colon and I've had, and these are incidental. It's not like somebody was known to have that thing. And definitely the conversion into small cell. Mm-hmm.
I could listen to the two of you all day long, but I think we're going to have to say goodbye. Thank you so much. It was really great. Audience, thank you for attending. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night.